Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Generations of organizing by labor unions, the working class, and the poor spawned a post-war New York City full of strong public institutions and a very generous welfare state. Today's guest, historian Kim Phillips Fine, writes, from rent regulation to tuition-free universities, from local health clinics to social services and public schools, from expanded library hours to free museum admissions and inexpensive mass transit, those policies and institutions embody the aspiration for a more egalitarian New York. By supporting a greater level of economic equality, they once helped create a more open city. But economic forces compounded by state and federal policies pushed the city to near bankruptcy in the mid-70s. In her new book, Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics, Kim Phillips Fine meticulously details how the underlying problems driving the crisis were overlooked. Instead, the blame was placed on the city's public sector, the poor, and immigrants. The politics quickly pivoted to personal responsibility. Public services were drastically cut, while corporations and wealthy individuals received tax breaks. And those changes are still with us today. Kim Phillips Fine is the author of Invisible Hands, The Businessman's Crusade Against the New Deal. She teaches history at New York University and has written for many publications, including The Nation, Dissent, and The Baffler. And her new book is Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. And Kim Phillips Fine joins us from her office in New York City. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
Wow. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for writing this book. I could not put it down.
Thank you.
And I think, yeah, the thing that really gets me is on this show, we talk a lot about how we got here today. Mm-hmm. Why do we have so much inequality, poverty, budget cuts, flat wages? And our guests usually start with Ronald Reagan. And you start with the late 60s and the early 70s in New York City.
Right. This is a this book is about the episode in the mid 70s when New York City almost went bankrupt. And yes, one of the arguments that I make in the book is that the near bankruptcy of the city became a moment of political transformation, and that for the right, it crystallized the idea that the welfare state was doomed to failure. And that it also really shifted what many liberals thought was possible.
And why don't more of us know about this? I didn't know about this, and I just don't hear historians or economists talk
right
about this.
Well, I think that I think one reason is that it's a story about. There might be some. People may see it as a local story and not recognize the extent to which what happened in New York became kind of a flashpoint for talking about the direction of the country as a whole. I think it also, in a way, the idea that the city, some of the ideas that came out of the crisis about the failures of liberalism and fiscal responsibility, as the idea that the there is no alternative to austerity, that idea kind of really triumphed, and in a way maybe makes it harder to remember some of the history or a time when that was less, when people didn't really believe that as much.
Right. Well, so before we talk about the bankruptcy in the mid-70s, let's talk about these incredible social services, this generous welfare state that New York City's labor unions, the working class, and the poor spent generations building. It's amazing to go back in that history.
Yeah. Well, I think so. New York City today I think people think of New York and they think of this kind of glittering capital of high finance and people think of the expensive artisanal life of Williamsburg. They think of the television show Girls. Maybe they think of Sex and the City. But I think that the part of the reason that New York is the city it is today has to do with this history of these remarkable public institutions. And yes, these kind of go back deep in the city's history, that there's a long history of union organizing in New York, a long history of left politics, And then, especially after the New Deal and the relationship that Mayor LaGuardia had with the Roosevelt administration during the 1930s, there's a kind of expansion of public works in the city. So New York in the middle years of the 20th century has free college tuition. It has a kind of a network of more than 20 municipal hospitals. It has a network of kind of municipal health clinics running throughout the entire city. It has, of course, the mass transit system, which is more extensive than anywhere else in the country and is, at that point, was kind of much less expensive than it is today. It has a public school system, which had, you know, kind of many, had kind of renowned programs in art and in music. So it really has this, it has, of course, its park system, with Central Park as, you know, and Prospect Park is kind of the best known parts of the park system, but really, you know, kind of a park system running throughout the five boroughs. To, you know, admission to the city's remarkable museums was free. There's this kind of a very robust set of public institutions that, you know, really still in many ways define what the city is now, and are built and expanded over the post-war years.
And since we're on the radio, I have to mention that you also report that New York City ran three radio stations two public television stations.
Right.
Which I love. And then also people could go to the theater, the opera, and the ballet for low prices.
Right.
You also report that life for people who lived in the wood frame houses dotting the half-industrial area was never easy. But even in the poorest neighborhoods, the city government provided substantial assistance in ways both large and small.
Right. I think one of the things that is, you know, New York during the post-war years is not, you know, it's not a utopia. There are still very deep divisions of class and of race in the city. But nonetheless, there is, you know, kind of at the same time, there is also this, this effort to, many of the things the city government is doing actually affect and improve the lives of people, even in the poorest parts of the city. The health clinics, the city ran immunization campaigns against the polio virus. There's a kind of expansion of public housing during the post-war years, again, partly funded with federal money. So even in the poorest parts of the city, people do benefit from the active efforts of the city government do improve the lives of people at all levels.
And then I also think this is important to point out. The working class was socially visible and politically strong. Unions were a recognized force and an accepted part of the life of the city as a whole.
Yeah, there was a very powerful labor movement in New York at this time, and it's important to realize that the city at this point is a much more blue collar and manufacturing city than it is today. So there were actually just literally more people engaged in industrial labor than there are in New York now. And yes, a kind of a strong, a high union density and a kind of cultural recognition of the role of this group of people in the city's life.
Talk a little bit about the politics of that time, because you do write that many times the elite would warn that the hospitals, the libraries, the schools, and the social workers placed an unsustainable weight on city budgets.
Right. Well, there's a kind of, over the post-war years, there is a kind of a tension that runs through the city's politics over, I think, both the size and scope of the local welfare state, and also over the, it's kind of another strain running through the city at that point is the tension over the presence of industry and manufacturing. And as early as the 1920s, there are, you know, kind of the visions of rezoning parts of Manhattan so that it's more oriented towards residential and commercial development, and trying to push industry out. And it's partly, you know, partly an effort to make the city into more of a white-collar elite space. So these struggles really intensify during the 1960s as the city's economy comes under increasing strain, and as I think it's also important to note that there's kind of pressure from below. Poor people's movements of the 1960s, both the organization, unionization of many of the city's public sector workers, as well as the welfare rights campaign, the Black Freedom Movement in New York, the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, different social movements kind of challenging and asking for more resources and more commitment to the health and welfare of poor working class and non-white communities in the city. And as this happens, there's a kind of increasing fear among elite groups in New York. And actually, one time this comes to a head is in the mid-60s, a stock transfer tax is passed. So this kind of gives a small tax every time a stock changes hands. And the New York Stock Exchange goes ballistic and threatens to move out of New York altogether, to go to Stamford, Connecticut, or perhaps even, I think, Eureka, California was considered briefly. So this is a kind of intense fear within the kind of upper levels of the stock exchange over the, kind of increasing tax burden that they think that wealthy people and businesses in New York will be asked to bear. And this, again, I think it's partly, it is partly about the taxes, but it's also, a question of who is the city government responsive to.
Right.
Who is listened to, whose voice has authority, and the concern of elite groups within the city that they, that they didn't have as much power as they wanted to.
You also write about so many people flocking to New York City for obvious reasons. People wanted jobs. They needed jobs.
Right.
And a lot of people were escaping the South.
Yes.
And between the late 1960s and the mid-1970s, 500,000 jobs disappeared from the city. Why did why did that happen?
Well, I think the flight of, many of these jobs that leave the New York over that time are industrial jobs. And part of what's happening in New York, although New York never was a kind of single industry town the way, say, Detroit was, with kind of really massive manufacturing companies employing tens of thousands of people making automobiles or something like that, the parts of the city that lose the most jobs are, for example, the garment industry, printing, kind of the light industry that had been the lifeblood of the kind of the working class population of the city. And those companies are leaving partly, partly to escape the labor unions and to try to find lower wage, lower tax places where they can make their goods. And they're able to do that partly because of all throughout the post-war years, but the creation of highway systems and roads that make this easier. There are locales in both kind of the suburbs of New York and then also farther away in the South, in the Caribbean and places where garment manufacturing would go to, regions that are offering much lower taxes, less labor regulation, less strong unions. And so I think that's really the force driving what's pulling those jobs away.
And as a result, people needed help. You report that the number of people in New York City, these are just astonishing numbers, how things changed in just 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
The number of people receiving some form of public assistance rose from almost 323,000 people in 1960 to 1.2 million in 1972, one out of every eight New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the city becomes much poorer. And the people who are, this is also, those years are, and I should say that this is a stunning growth, but it's actually not, you see something similar in many other cities at the same time. Mm-hmm. Those are the years when the program, or when welfare or aid to families with dependent children, the regulations around kind of who's eligible to receive it are relaxed substantially at the federal level. And there's also kind of mobilizations of poor women who are, who are starting to articulate a kind of right to receive some sort of support for themselves and to raise their children. So there is the kind of expansion of, you know, what's happening in New York is remarkable, but it also is in this context of the growth of the welfare system at the national level, too.
And then when you talk about how people perceived taxes, mm-hmm. you write that Italians, Poles, Jews, and other working class white people in the city began to resent that their tax dollars were being used to benefit people they viewed as, quote, unworthy and inferior, mm-hmm. African Americans and Latinos. And then you also write that a lot of business people didn't like the expansive social sector because they thought that their taxes were being used to basically provide services for the poor. So
right.
you had business people with that thinking, and then you also had working class white people, Jews and Italians.
Yeah, there's a kind of, I mean, I think this is, you know, two different groups and for somewhat different reasons,
right.
but there's an increasing, there's a way in which earlier in the post-war years, the city's local welfare state had been perceived as kind of benefiting the people of New York, and, you know, the people of New York paid for it, the people of New York benefited from it. And as the post-war years go on, there's an increasing tension over who is benefiting from it, who is paying for it. And some of the, you know, there's a kind of racism that emerges as poor people of color are kind of seen to be the ones who are really using and benefiting from these programs, while other groups are paying for them. So,
did you think much when you were writing this book about what the city could have done, taken a completely different course? I mean, we're at a point where people
yeah.
are leaving the city, so the tax base is lower.
Mm-hmm.
The elite do not want to pay taxes
right.
that to pay for these social services, and yet because people aren't finding work, the need
right.
is much greater.
Right.
What
yeah,
other?
And I think one of the things that happens is the city starts to act almost as an employer. The kind of city employment is going up at this point. This is partly because there's actually just more demand for city services, so more people are needed to staff the city government. But also, the city is in some ways acting as a employer of last resort and hiring people, which is, you know, kind of giving them jobs, but maybe not solving the underlying problem of the loss of employment. So you're asking, what could the city have done differently at this point?
Right.
Well, I think one question that emerges from this history is the city are city governments the place to take on these issues of poverty and inequality? Should the city have kind of tried to turn to the federal government to not just give short-term support, but to rethink the basis on which it was financing its programs and to try to get the federal government to take more dramatic action? This might not, I think, you know, politically, this would have been very difficult to accomplish at this moment in the early 1970s, but I think that in a longer-term structural sense, cities, it might have, in a long-term structural sense, it's not clear that cities can kind of bear the weight of these kinds of problems and issues alone. New York was addressing problems of inequality, economic and racial inequality that had their origins far beyond its borders, and yet the city was the place where these problems were kind of coming to bear, and the city was the government that was trying to take action to deal with them. I think, you know, one example of this is that one of the major costs that New York City's government was bearing was the cost of Medicaid and welfare. Of AFDC, and in New York State, localities. So those programs are all, they're split between the federal government and the state. All, you know, that's how the split works in general. But then at the state level, in New York State, localities were picking up about 20 to 25% of the bill of those programs. That was much higher than anywhere else in the country. Some cities didn't bear any cost. Some bore maybe 5-10%. It was very unusual for a city to have to bear that much of the cost. Had the funding for that kind of program been structured differently, New York's budget would have looked very different.
Hmm.
I think more generally the point is true too, that these are problems of national import. What, you know, can, the best response that cities may, you know, ultimately be able to make is to both, in addition to doing what they can locally, to kind of put them as problems for the country as a whole.
Today we're speaking with Kim Phillips Fine. She teaches history at New York University, and her new book is called Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. She writes that the 1970s crisis was a crucial point on the way to a new New York, helping transform the city into a highly stratified metropolis it is today, a city of apartments bought as investment properties for the wealthy of the world, even as almost 60,000 New Yorkers live in homeless shelters, a city that's among the most unequal in a country that has itself become radically more hierarchical than it was during the post-war era. It's such an interesting book because as we talk about how we got here today with so much inequality and poverty, we often start with Ronald Reagan. But as Kim Phillips Fine writes in her new book, we really need to look at what happened in New York City in the early 70s. And the big question that comes out of this book is, what is the role of government? And we'd love to hear from you. What is the role of government at this time? A lot of homeless advocates in San Francisco say, if you really want to solve this problem, you need to fund HUD. It's just, it's too big for the city. So what are your thoughts? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And if you lived in New York at this time, we'd love to hear from you. I just, it's amazing to think about the drastic changes that this city went through with free childcare, subways, art, colleges, and then massive, massive budget cuts. So if you lived through that time, we'd love to hear your story. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Before we talk about how the federal government dealt with this, you have so many amazing stories of the various mayors in New York that tried to deal with this issue. Obviously, we can't talk about all of them, but what really stood out for you about how the let's say the Democratic mayors dealt with this?
Right. Well, I think the mayor who wound up being there were really two mayors who figure especially in this story, John Lindsay and Abe Beam. And the two men could not have been more different. Lindsay was tall, handsome. People described him as a kind of matinee idol. He had gone to elite private schools. He went to Yale. He was a kind of golden boy and a kind of very popular. The New York Times enthusiastically endorsed him. He was the mayor in the late 60s and the very early 1970s. And Lindsay was a very idealistic man. He actually ran on the Republican ticket in New York. He was kind of independent from the city's unions. He was not part of the Democratic machine, and he oversaw the kind of expansion in the late 60s. So there's a moment when the city is getting a tremendous amount of additional money from the federal government to expand different kinds of services for poor people. And Lindsay is mayor at this moment and kind of overseeing that expansion. In 1973, Abraham Beam comes in. And Beam was short. He was actually the city's first Jewish mayor. He was a kind of product of the Democratic machine. He had come up through, he'd been born, he came to the United States as a infant. He was under a year old when his family emigrated here. He grew up on the Lower East Side. His father was a socialist. He kind of went to the settlement house in the neighborhood. He was kind of part of he really grew up in poverty on the Lower East Side, and he went to City College for free and became an accountant and then kind of worked his way up within the city government. But both Lindsay and then later Beam confronted this dilemma as they got into office. There was they had this major set of city social programs, but the revenues to pay for them were, especially as the 60s turned into the 70s, it wasn't, you know, they weren't there. And the city's budget office, I think this is another kind of critical point was it was highly disorganized as well. The city actually didn't do a very good job keeping track of its finances, and in certain, you know, the city would kind of, they tried to sort of finesse and fudge the issue by, for example, over-projecting how much money they were likely to get from the federal government, and then never really correcting the books when that money didn't come in. They used the capital budget, which is meant to pay for infrastructure and long-term repairs. They kind of shifted some of that money over to pay for annual expenses. And in general, they would go every year. The city, New York, is not actually able to simply impose its own taxes. New taxes have to be, permission to impose them comes from Albany. Both Lindsay and Beam would go every year to Albany to ask for new taxing powers. They were usually granted some, but rare, not as much as they were asking for. And slowly the city began to increase the amount of short-term debt that it was taking on. So essentially what both Lindsay and then Beam, to a much greater extent, did was try to avoid having a political conflict over the size and scope of the welfare state, and instead to borrow, to just try to fund it in an annual way by increasing the amount of debt that the city was taking on.
Today we're speaking with Kim Phillips Fine, author of the new book, Fierce City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. After the break, we'll talk about the new era of tax cuts in New York and how the fiscal crisis reshaped the Democratic Party and liberalism. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
And I'm Matt Martin, General Manager of KALW, here with Laura Flynn, producer of Your Call, taking 2 minutes from this cool conversation about, in-depth conversation. Conversation that gives you a different understanding of our current situation and our history. You make this conversation possible when you make a call to 800-525-9917 or go online at KALW.org.
And if you make a gift of $120, you will get Kim's fascinating book, Fierce City. Kim meticulously details how austerity politics didn't really start with Reagan, but stretches farther back to New York City in the mid-70s.
That's right. We appreciate the context here on Your Call and on KALW, not just the headlines, not just the tweets going back and forth, but how our economy, how our politics have evolved, or devolved, as it may be. Your support makes that possible. The number to call, 800-525-9917. Show your support for Your Call. These conversations happen because of listener support.
And again, that number is 800-525-9917, or you can give at KALW.org. And on Your Call, we really value inviting you to the conversation that provide greater context for the issues we face today.
800-525-9917. Thanks to Alan Fisher in San Francisco, Stephen Doherty, also here in the city, who gave their support at KALW.org in just the past few minutes. We thank you so much.
Thank you.
800-525-9917.
Again, that's 800-525-9917, KALW.org.
800-525-9917. You can talk to our phone room volunteers. They'll tell you about Fear City, the book that we're hearing the interview about right now. That's yours for a $120 contribution. But at every level of support, you are making a difference.
Again, that's 800-525-9917, or visit KALW.org to make your gift today.
Thank you so much to everyone who's getting involved. We're going to go back to the conversation between Rose Aguilar and Kim Phillips Fine.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and Kim Phillips Fine teaches history at New York University. Her latest book is called Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. When we do shows about how we got to where we are today, a lot of our guests tend to start with Ronald Reagan. But as Kim writes in her book, we really need to look at what happened in New York City in the early 70s. New York City had an expansive and very generous welfare state. The city's fiscal crisis caused that contract to really come crashing down. It's remarkable when you look at the numbers. Kim was just talking about Mayor Beam, and in May 1975, he announced severe reductions in salaries, pensions, and working conditions, plus the layoff of over 51,000 city workers. So you can imagine how this really shocked the city. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 8255. If you were in New York at this time, we'd love to hear your story about the changes that you've seen. And then the bigger question that Kim raises in her book is, what is the role of government? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Maury in San Francisco. Hi, Maury. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. And thank you so much, Kim, for your book. I can't wait to read it. In the late 70s, I was vice president for industrial development for the city, and the operating information that we had at the time was that 650,000 manufacturing jobs had migrated from the city to the south, primarily because manufacturing in New York City was vertical. There were
right.
multi-floors, so
right.
products came, you know, raw materials came in on the ground, they went up to the top floor, let's say the eighth, and then they progressed down through elevators. And when technology improved mostly in the south, where they had land, manufacturing became horizontal. So a truck just pulled up to the back door, stuff went on the conveyor belt, and another truck picked it up on the other end. New York City did not have that luxury.
Right.
of horizontal space.
Hmm.
So that was one factor. The other is that, remember good old George Wallace, who provided transportation and cash
mm-hmm.
to African Americans who would leave the South and go north. So at the time when 650,000 manufacturing jobs went south, this mass migration of unskilled labor came from the south to the north. So New York City was in a vice grip, you know, when its tax base was eroding just in manufacturing alone,
mm-hmm.
And payroll taxes, when there was this massive migration of
mm-hmm.
people who needed all kinds of social services. So that was part of what was going on. In my office, we were hysterical. We worked like 12-hour days without overtime, trying to get grants from the federal government, the state government, to convince some manufacturing to stay in the city. And we were partially successful, but the trend was so massive. You know, the advantage of horizontal manufacturing versus vertical was so great that most small manufacturers, which is what New York City had, couldn't compete. So
thank you,
stressful time, and just even talking about it brings back my nervous system goes on high alert.
Right.
Wow.
Yes, one of the things that's been really interesting about working on this book is speaking with people who lived through this time. And yeah, the many, many intense memories that people have about it, both within the city government and in the rest of the city.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Maury, and I hope you can get your hands on this book. We have another story from a listener who lived in New York in the 60s. Let's go to Martha in Oakland. Hi, Martha.
Hello, it's Marga.
Oh, hi, Marga.
I just want to thank for the book, and I hope maybe cast more light on the slightly earlier period. I came up from Boston's WGBH to start educational television, they called it, in New York in 1959. And John Lindsay as mayor had strong... I came actually from a job at the Harvard Business School, and they were very much against creeping inflation, which worked then. My rent control apartment with a beautiful view, although for a walk up, was $48 a month.
Wow.
My salary as a TV producer was $60 a month.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a week. So it was a wonderful time, and I loved living in my international low income building. And I didn't like what happened later on with the inflation. I can't afford to live now, but I like to hear how we got from there to here. So thank you for
Right.
your book.
Well, thank you for calling in.
Thank you so much, Martha. Let's go next to Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was born in 61 in New York City, and my mother was a community activist and had a daycare center, a community-controlled daycare center.
Oh, wow.
Called Child Flower Daycare Center in the Lower East Side. So I remember a lot during that period of time. But I just want to mention something that is really interesting that came out of Howard Zinn's book. And few people realize that the Trilateral Commission on Investment was formed during that time, during 1972, by Rockefeller and Brzezinski. Mm-hmm. And he makes a really interesting comparison. He says in 1960, there were 8 United States banks with foreign branches. In 1974, there were 129.
Right.
The assets of these overseas branches amounted to $3.5 billion in 1960 and $155 billion in 1974. So in essence, basically the banking system and all these major corporations and their intermingling board of directors transferred assets and took away the money from the wealth and the commonwealth of the people and everything that the people were producing as workers. So my answer to what can be done is to create our own public banking system. And that's basically what I believe. And I think that's something that is very powerful. And something that would mean that we could reintroduce and reinvest in our communities as a result.
Well, it's really interesting. You know, at the time, during the fiscal crisis, there were people who advocated the creation of some kind of public banking system that would be able to, make loans to cities like New York. So with this idea, there wasn't kind of political support and traction for it. But it's interesting that people did propose that kind of, there was a vision of something like that that was discussed at the time.
Mm. Well, thank you, Lisa. I've been seeing public banking getting a lot more media attention, and I'm going to add that to my show list. So thank you for calling. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Kim Phillips Fine. She teaches history at New York University, and her latest book is Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. Let's fast forward a bit, Kim. We really need 3 hours to talk about your whole book. But I want to talk about what happened with all of these layoffs, because you had 15,000 workers initially laid off, 1,600 firefighters. There was so much chaos and uncertainty. Can you talk about that and how it unfolded?
Right. So, well, I guess to zoom the story forward, in the spring of 1975, the banks, which have been financing the city's debt, and as the caller pointed out, these were banks that increasingly had a lot of things going on outside of there was a general liberalization of banking laws, and also the great expansion of overseas banking. The banks, in other words, have a lot less commitment to financing cities like New York. So they no longer are willing to underwrite the city's debt. I mean, they say that there's kind of increasing concern throughout the investment community about the stability of New York, and there's no longer a market for the city's bonds. So the city then goes into it relies on borrowing in order to meet its bills and expenses. And for most of the rest of 1975, many people believe that the default of New York City on its debt is basically inevitable, and that the city will wind up in bankruptcy court eventually. Now, this doesn't happen, but one of the things the city does to stave it off is kind of start to lay off ultimately about a fifth of its between a fifth and a sixth of its workforce. And these layoffs are kind of they're carried out in a very chaotic way. So often the city would lay off workers and then hire some of them back and then lay them off again. The cuts are sort of haphazard and pretty disorganized. There's not really a kind of central. There's not really an effort to assess at some central level. Kind of which programs might be most effectively cut. There's a kind of a haphazard, chaotic quality to the cuts, which in and of itself, I think, helped deliver the message that social services and publicly funded social services are kind of unstable and not unreliable, and not, you know, kind of not a expression of strength, but instead a kind of that they really can't be counted on. So the city closes hospitals, it shuts down clinics, it stops funding a range of different drug treatment programs, it lays off thousands and thousands of teachers. The school day is actually shortened by about 90 minutes. Many of the extracurriculars in the schools, the art, the music, the sports teams, are simply eliminated or cut back very drastically. The city starts to charge tuition at the public university. The transit fare is raised. Many daycares, like the caller who spoke about her mother and the daycare center, many daycares lost their city funding. So there's these cuts, you know, kind of affect many, many different parts of the life of the city.
And as you report, this did not just affect New York City. This left governments everywhere scrambling to fund their public services. These economic, just cities that were hit by economic issues and problems.
Right. New York isn't the only city in the 1970s to have this kind of crisis. Famously, Cleveland does as well, and others too, going out of the 70s and onwards.
How did civil society respond to these massive cuts?
Right. Well, one of the things I was very interested in, so in New York, one of the common narratives about the crisis is that people in New York kind of understood that their government had acted irresponsibly and quickly got on board with the cutbacks and the program of austerity. And one of the things that I was really amazed by working on this subject is how widespread and intense and emotional the protests about the cuts really were. That people experienced this as a kind of profound shift in expectations and what they thought they could expect from their city government, and a profound shift in the sense of mutual obligations, what people thought they could expect from each other. So there are protests throughout the city, many different kinds of things. There are marches. There are kind of wildcat strikes of public sector workers who are being laid off. There are sleep-ins and occupations of libraries that are threatened with closure. There are major protests at the city universities and especially at campuses that were threatened with closure. Again, kind of occupations, sit-ins, takeovers. Probably one of the stories that I tell in the book is of the People's Firehouse in the neighborhood of North Williamsburg in Brooklyn, where it was a Polish and Italian neighborhood where local residents essentially took over and slept in the firehouse for about 16 months, believing that as long as they were there, the city couldn't actually drive away the fire engine, and formally close the station. It was one of the longest such occupations, but there were many shorter ones throughout the city. So these cutbacks are really quite profoundly resisted and are not met with kind of equanimity and easy acceptance at all.
They also resulted in a drastic increase in crime.
Right. Well, the crime rates were they had been climbing throughout the 1970s. So I don't know if I would exactly say that the cutbacks by themselves caused the increase in crime. I think what's most striking, though, is that these cutbacks were enacted at a moment when crime was rising, when parts of the city, most famously the South Bronx and the neighborhood of Bushwick in Brooklyn, had these waves of fire. Both fire just caused by kind of abandonment and disrepair, as well as actual arson by landlords who were burning down buildings to collect insurance money. But arson and fire is spreading to the city, crime is rising, poverty is rising, and these cutbacks come, you know, in the midst of that. So it's as though the you know, kind of human needs and social needs are kind of so present, so evident, so visible, and yet are just being denied because of the city's fiscal situation.
Then you get what you call a new New York, and you write about the Commodore Hotel, which is a 26-story building, and it was owned by the Penn Central Railroad. The hotel fell into disrepair after the railroad declared bankruptcy in 1970, and Penn Central was very eager to sell the property. And who appeared to buy that hotel?
Well, that was... none other than Donald Trump, who was 29 years old in 1976. Trump was already a wealthy man, but the Commodore Hotel deal would be his first real entree into New York real estate, into Manhattan real estate, from his father, who owned, you know, tens of thousands of apartments in the outer boroughs. And what Trump wanted to do was buy the Commodore, working with the Hyatt Regency hotel chain, and to purchase the property, then to sell it to the state, to the Urban Development Corporation, a state agency, and then lease it back from the state. And through this deal, avoid paying a percentage of the property taxes, a percentage that as of last year, the New York Times did a report on this, had been worth more than $350 million to Trump and to Hyatt. So it was getting a very favorable set of terms. And this deal at the time was people, you know, argued about whether this was the right thing for the city, because obviously the city was nearly bankrupt. It needed revenue. How could it be entering into these, you know, property tax? How could it be giving this kind of massive property tax break? But the city government, and I think this is actually an important point, the city government, this is not, although Trump, you know, kind of course, praised himself and his canny deal making, this wasn't just the story of somebody exploiting a prostrate city. The city government actually really promoted the Trump deal. And city officials said, we want to celebrate this as a sign to the business community that New York is going to do things differently from now on, that we're going to be welcoming to corporations, that we're going to use the city government to give subsidies, to give tax breaks, to do what companies want us to do. So the city's economic development administrator, you know, kind of praises the deal and then promotes it to the broader business community. But yes, I think it's really literally true that Trump, and there are many ways in which Trump was, I think, shaped by the fiscal crisis, but his climb in Manhattan real estate circles, which often involved this aggressive, you know, kind of finding ways to get these kinds of property tax breaks and other deals for his development, it really grows out of the fiscal crisis very literally.
And then, as you write, the city's policies really shifted to attract developers and the wealthy. And Kim, we have about 3 minutes left.
Oh, really? Okay.
So I want to bring this back to today, because you write that today, as in the 70s, austerity remains a political choice. When you wrote this book, you know, we're dealing with all of these issues today. And what are your thoughts about how we can move away from this narrative? Just about the forces that make it seem the only option obscure the underlying reasons why cities become poor, why wealthy metropolises come to have government starve for funds. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I guess I would say two things. One is that it's always important to try to broaden out and to look at the structural and historical forces that shape the array of options available to a city government. I think you could think about this, for example, with Puerto Rico, which just today announced it was entering into bankruptcy court and has been undergoing a kind of restructuring that resembles what happened in New York during the 70s. But I think at its heart, this is a book which is about it's about hubris and power and the ability of people with access to power and resources to make decisions without kind of a democratic relationship with the people who are most deeply affected. But it's also really a book about community and about what we can expect from each other. And the question, it's what our social priorities really are. How can it be that in a country that remains the wealthiest in the world, that spends billions of dollars on military infrastructure, how can it be that we have cities that are in poverty and people living in despair? And to try to think about those relationships and what our priorities are, how we enact them through our government, how we enact them through our taxes and our spending, and to ask, is this, what can we really expect from each other, and how can we build a society that lifts everybody up?
And just one more minute, you have some really interesting anecdotes about how this affected conservatives and liberals. Mm-hmm. What really strikes you about how this changed the Democrats and the Democratic Party?
Well, I think in New York, what is really striking and in some ways sad about the story is the way that the city's liberals, and I think they're kind of moving in tandem with the broader Democratic Party during the 1970s, but they come to share the belief that the only way to fund liberal programs is by shifting the resources of the state to help business, and that the only way to get money to fund programs for poor people is to kind of get more wealthy people living in the city, and then you'll be able to somehow capture a part of that and use it for poor people. It's a kind of almost like a trickle-down liberalism or something like that. And I think that, while I think this story is very helpful for understanding why they came to see things that way and why that became the main interpretation, but I also think you can see the limits of it from this story, too. And, I think we need a different way to think about politics, one that isn't as dependent on using the resources of government to cater to the very rich. The result of that in New York and elsewhere has often been deals that actually don't wind up delivering the jobs, the good jobs that are promised, deals that don't wind up delivering the resources for the kind of equal funding of the city's infrastructure, of its parks, of its schools, but actually really create two separate cities, one for the wealthy and one for the poor, and not even really space for a middle class. So I think we need to rethink. Yeah. Anyway, I'm out of time, but I think we need to rethink how the sort of the limits of that story, even if we understand maybe from the story of the fiscal crisis, more of how and why Democrats came to put it forward. Mm.
Kim Phillips-Fine teaches history at New York University, and her latest book is Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. Kim, thank you for joining us, and thank you for sharing these stories with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on, and thank you to the callers, too. It was great to hear.
Yes, great stories. I'm Rose Aguilar at Shore Call, and thank you for joining us. And I'm joined here in studio by Matt Martin. Hi, Matt.
Good morning, Rose. Many people to thank this morning here at KALW, including Mark Schmitter in San Francisco, Clyde Bone in Oakland, and Amiko Omori in San Francisco, all of whom have given their support in this hour of your call at KALW.org. We have just a few minutes before we go to On Point. And right now we have a challenge, and that is to get 13 people to support KALW. And if that happens, by the end of this hour, Sandy and David Schmeyer of Burlingame and Stuart McKenzie of Oakland will give an additional $400 to local public radio. At every level of support, you are counted toward this challenge. If you give $50, that helps us toward the 13 calls and the additional $400. If you give $500 or $1,000, that will make a big difference for us. But the key thing is to participate, and you can get Kim Phillips-Fine's new book, Fear City, for a $120 contribution. Make a call now to 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. You can also go online to KALW.org. I will be honest, I could not put this book down.
Really?
Really interesting stories. And I just kept feeling like, this sounds so familiar. And I know so many of you appreciate the shows we do about history and about how we got here. And I really think that you would appreciate this book, Fear City by Kim Phillips-Fine, for a $120 contribution to local public radio. We will send you a copy, 800-525-9917. You can also go online to KALW.org.
I appreciate the way you were talking about these narratives that shape the way we think about what's possible in cities, in our economy, in our society. Whose interest are those decisions being made? And based on what story about how things really work? Kim Phillips-Fine book specifically talks about New York City, but this obviously, these are lessons that certainly apply here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yep.
Your support at 800-525-9917 or by clicking that donate button at klw.org keeps this conversation going.
800-525-9917 or klw.org. Toward the end of the show, Kim was saying that we need a different way to think about politics, and your call is a place where we can have those conversations.
Yeah.
And that's why this station is so crucial, especially at this time. 800-525-9917. You can also go online to klw.org.
We need to have these conversations about real things that don't just, you know, we're not just saying like, oh, what's the immediate question right now? It's saying, no, let's have a little more context.
Yep.
Let's talk about our experience. Let's talk about the different places different people are in our society, in our cities. How do we come together and make something that makes sense? Your support keeps that space open for intelligent, in-depth conversation that you have a voice in. 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. You can also go online to klw.org. We come to you twice a year to ask you to support local independent radio, and we wouldn't have it any other way. 800-525-9917. It is so important to support a station like KALW, especially in this political climate. 800-525-9917 or klw.org.
15 seconds till we go to On Point. Every contribution that comes in until 5 after the hour will count towards this challenge. So you can go to KALW.org, start the process there. It'll be time-stamped. It'll let us know you want that to count, or call 800-525-9917.
800-525-9917, KALW.org.
Thank you.
Thank you.